Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2002, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a fashion designer. Rebelling against the secure middle-class upbringing of her Lancashire town, she took off to the local art college and then on to Birmingham, where she studied textiles. A terrible car accident in which she lost a leg dented her confidence, but bit by bit she built it back again. By the age of 32, in partnership with the man who became her husband, she launched her own label, which took all the best stores and later the world market by storm. In 1985, she won British Designer of the Year. Those heady days are now over, but she's still regarded as one of our most experienced and level-headed fashion designers. Her clothes appeal to a wide range, from Cherie Blair to the princesses of pop. They're chic but unstructured, often witty, but always wearable. I don't want people to say, "She's wearing my label," she says. I just want them to say, "She's looking stunning." She is Betty Jackson. Is it still a thrill, Betty, seeing people, famous or not, dressed in your clothes?
I think it's the biggest thrill, and I think it's the thrill that sort of goes on and on, really, yeah. Just the fact that somebody's gone out and chosen what you have actually created and bought it with their hard-earned cash and stuff like that.
Great compliment.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you ever saw anybody?
Yeah, it was very funny because I was actually driving through Grosvenor Square and I saw this woman walking along the pavement and screeched to a halt and wound my window down and said, "Hello, how are you?" And she recoiled in horror.
Complete stranger.
And of course I didn't know who she was at all, but I just recognised what she was wearing. And felt so foolish, I can't tell you how silly I felt. And drove off, you know, in complete confusion and leaving this sort of woman thinking that she was about to be attacked by this insane...
But the temptation must have been in those early days, before you were so recognisable, to kind of loiter in department stores and see what they were doing.
Yeah, I have done that. I've actually been shadowed by a store detective before now because, well, it happened in a big department store in London and we delivered the new collection to them. This was quite a long time ago. And it had only been in a couple of days and they'd sort of reported back that they were doing quite well with it. And some woman, you know, whilst I was actually there, picked something off the rails and then went along a bit further and picked about three or four things and went into the changing room. And I just couldn't bear not to know whether she was buying it or not. And so I sort of hung around and hung around. But it took her ages. And so eventually the store manager came across and asked me if I was... requiring any help.
Loitering with intent.
Yes, absolutely.
But I suppose the other side of that coin is, you know, if in your shop, and you currently have one, someone puts something on and says, "Oh, God, this is awful." Yes. You know, that must be very depressing.
Yes, but I don't think you can please everybody all the time.
And they've got to look right in it, and you've got to tell them when they don't.
When they don't look right.
Otherwise they don't come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And because you have to suit quite a wide section of ages, figures, style, then not everything is going to be right for everybody. So you're sort of ready for that, really.
But it's always right for you. Like all sensible designers, you only wear your own clothes. Describe how you're dressed today. Let me start by saying it's all black.
And I've got a laced-up
sort of boot laces,
jacket. Boot laces. It was our sort of boxer tip. And it's got a hood on it, which is quite nice. And it's nice soft leather. And then jersey T-shirt and a frilled skirt.
Yes, the skirt is... I mean, it's sort of slightly evening look.
You just need clothes that work for you in any situation, I think.
And you don't do evening clothes.
No.
In fact, you don't manufacture them, do you?
No, I'm not very good at it. I never understood that ball gown thing. I sort of think that you should be able to just change your shoes and your earrings and go off anywhere.
Essentially, the look is relaxed,
easy,
comfortable.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Not power dressing for you,
ever. No, I know. I never understood power dressing, I must say.
Tell me about your first record.
First record, Nina Simone, I Got Life. It's about the privilege of actually doing what I've always wanted to do. And I suppose as I get older, I'm now geriatric in the fashion world, it becomes clearer and clearer that I have been so lucky to still do it. And fundamentally, I absolutely love it to bits.
got my back, I got my sack. I got my arms, got my hands, got my fingers, got my legs, got my feet, got my toes, got my liver, got my blood, I've got life.
It's groovy. Nina Simone singing I Got Life. Betty Jackson, you say you're geriatric as far as the fashion trade is concerned. You're only in your early 50s, hardly that. But it is a comment, really, that on our British fashion, isn't it? We don't have an answer to Armani or Yves Saint Laurent or Calvin Klein, you know, all of whom seem to have developed and gone on. I mean, Armani's 60-odd now, isn't he? Why haven't we?
I think it's something to do with the structure of the business, and certainly American companies employing your marketing manager and your sales manager first. And the British are great at creativity, but hopeless at selling themselves. I mean, we were always hopeless at selling. We didn't have a sales team until really quite recently.
So is it lack of business acumen, or is it lack of manufacturing resources? Because, again, I think you have your stuff made abroad.
Yeah. Well, some of it is made here. But this country, you can actually make an awful lot of one thing. It's geared to the high street, Marks and Spencer's sort of production. And they make 5,000 of a style, and I come along and say, can you make 350 of these jackets? And, of course, they don't want to know because they're slightly more complicated and, you know, they're not as easy to push through a factory.
But how come they want to know in Italy when they've got Gucci to make or Armani to make?
Because they've actually worked out a two-tier system in the factories in Italy. They see the designers that they're making 300 of a style for now, they're going to be the ones that they're going to be making 10,000.
So why don't we see that here?
I've never worked that out.
And then we get people like, I mean, the famous name Stella McCartney, Alexander McQueen, going abroad. You know, there's talk of a sort of designer drain.
Well, they're owned by Italian companies, that's all. And, you know, in a way, that's right for now, because I wouldn't want anybody to have to struggle as we had to struggle. So I think they're absolutely right, because at least they'll get their clothes beautifully made, beautifully manufactured, and out to the right people.
But it's the old story, really, isn't it? It's a bit like penicillin, you know. We kind of discover it, create it, as it were, and then someone else exploits it.
I think, though, I mean, certainly our colleges and our schools produce, and just this place produces the most creative energy. I mean, there'll always be another generation of creative people, I think. I think that's what we're really, really good at.
Record number two.
Record number two is John Lennon, which is sort of to do with me being independent from my elder sister and choosing my music instead of Helen Shapiro and Cliff Richard. And also, because it's John Lennon, and he just was the most wonderful, sexiest man, and I think I was in love with him from the age of about 12 and a half until 32 or something. I just love his voice, and it's a good one to dance to.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it, it's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it, gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me, if you wanna dance with me, I got no kick against modern jazz.
The Beatles and rock and roll music and the sound of your youth, Betty Jackson, in Bake Up, nearest big town, Rochdale, nearest city, Manchester. Did you go there very often?
It was a bit of an excursion, really. In school holidays, we used to go with my mother to Kendall Mills and sit in the restaurant, and she used to choose her suits for the season. There were sort of, you know, models walking around with numbers on their wrists. And
as you sat drinking your coffee.
Yeah. Mm. And it was big city. It seemed huge. And then when I sort of went back, I couldn't believe how small Deansgate was. Mm. But Manchester was really where the action was, but a complete sort of day's excursion.
Was she very glamorous then?
My mother was quite glamorous, yes. She was tall and beautiful, but we used to mistake her for Ingrid Bergman on the street. I do remember her coming down the stairs in very glamorous evening frocks. You know, used to sort of really dress up to go out.
So what were you in then? Were you in smocked frocks and Peter Pan
collars? Yeah. Liberty Prince. Dressed exactly the same as my sister, which I was furious about for quite a long time.
And how did your father pay for all of this? What did he do?
He had a small shoe manufacturing business. So it was a sort of local industry, really, because all the cotton industry had gone over to the shoe.
And you went to the local grammar school, mm-hmm. and it was all pretty predictable stuff. Yeah. And you were good at English and history, mm-hmm. and you were going to go to university, mm-hmm. All those things. Yeah. Absolutely straight down the line. And then suddenly, as I put it in the introduction, you rebelled.
Well, hardly a rebellion. But the only thing that I knew was what I didn't want to do. And when it came to filling in my ACCA form, I just went to the headmistress and said, I'm not going to do this. And I was so frightened when I sort of sat, I think I stood opposite her. She was sitting, I was standing. And I said the first thing that came into my head was, which was, I'm going to go to art college. At which point she almost fell off her seat. I, called my parents to the school, and it was a big stuff. Then I thought, it was all the time of sex and drugs and rock and roll, in the end of the 60s. So that was sort of very exciting stuff.
So art college was where it was at?
Absolutely. Political rebellion and all of that thing was happening. But Dad was quite clever, really, because he said, OK, you want to go to art school, you want to pursue a career in the arts, so you must go to this particular art school. So instead of sending me off to Hornsey and where it all was happening, I had to go to Rochdale.
Which was 5 minutes down
the road. 5 minutes down the road. And everybody, all of my contemporaries, were all going off to Cambridge and Oxford and very glamorous places. And I went to Rochdale. Oh, gosh, it was just the worst. But anyway, the thing about it was that the moment I got there, it was sort of what I'd been missing. Suddenly, I found all these people who were expressing themselves in other ways. And it was the most wonderful time.
You'd felt right.
Yeah.
You'd sort of instinctively known what you really should
do. Yeah, so it was a sort of leap into the dark as far as I was concerned. Because all I could do was draw. And, at school, we'd done perspective and I'd thrown a pot. So it was quite a thing to discover all of the things that you could do at art school, lithographs and screen printing and fabrics and textures and colours and painting and sculpture and all of that stuff. So it was a good decision.
Record number three.
Dusty Springfield. She's just, it was her time then, and I absolutely love her voice and still makes my hair stand on end, this beginning.
When I said I needed you, you don't have to say you love me, just be close at hand.
Dusty Springfield, and you don't have to say you love me. You wanted to be a sculptor, I think, first of all.
Well, that was my first idea, I suppose, because the only thing I knew about was fine art. There was a bit of a flaw there, though, because I'm allergic to plaster of Paris. So the first time I tried, for a start with sculpture, and I just came up in big red blotches, and I can't do it. So next best thing was fabric and texture and colour and print and pattern and putting it together.
I suppose it has something in common, doesn't it?
Three-dimensional, yeah.
So on you went after that foundation year in Rochdale to Birmingham College of Art, and it was while you were there that you had this dreadful car accident. How did it happen?
Well, I drove a car into a tree early one morning, and the steering went on the car, they found later.
So was your leg amputated in the accident, or was it later?
It was quite complicated. There was a lot of things done because it was a bit sort of touch and go, and the only thing I remember is sort of hanging upside down outside of the car and somebody running towards me. But anyway, everybody swung into action, and they were absolutely marvellous at Birmingham Accident Hospital. And I got to know my surgeon terribly well because he kept having to come and say he was very sorry, but they'd have to operate again. So we became very good friends, in fact. And then it took me quite a long time.
Physically, how long did it take?
I suppose to learn to stand up and move around, which I don't do terribly well even now, was about 18 months, 2 years.
And psychologically? much longer.
Well, I think you just need help with that. I think I had so much support. And I also think I'm sort of horribly optimistic as a person. And, you know, dark days, of course. But when I knew I was going to live, I don't think then you give up, really. The most annoying thing was all the things I had to give up, like horse riding and running for a bus and walking up and downstairs.
And dancing.
I still dance quite a bit, much to the shame of my children. But it's all those things that are really quite annoying. And also the fact that everybody, you know, tries to sort of make allowances, which I absolutely hate as well. Because it's just a fact now, and you just get on with the rest of your life, you know. It also made me realise that you did function alone. I do believe that you come into life on your own and you leave life on your own, and there's certain things that you have to deal with on your own. But it also taught me about the importance of other people around you. You know, the help that you get and the love that you get, really.
Record number four.
Well, this was actually about being in Birmingham, dancers in the student union, and about Motown being the most fantastic sound. And it's probably one of the saddest records, but he has the most beautiful voice as well, Smokey Robinson.
Oh, you see my smile.
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Tracks of My Tears. How long did you sit at home for, Betty, after the accident?
About 18 months, I think.
And how did you get going then?
I had a great friend at college called Adrian Cartmell. He couldn't ever draw, and I always used to do his illustrations at college. He got this fantastic job as a knitwear designer, and he still couldn't draw. So he used to whiz things up the motorway for me to draw, and then I used to send them down. And it sort of grew from there. I used to illustrate his collection, and then a couple of people saw them and wanted to use them in magazines. And it was the only thing I could do lying down, you see, so it was perfect, really. I mean, it wasn't huge, but it was a start, and I felt that I was sort of still part of something, which was very important.
So. And in the end, you did get your confidence back, and you went to London and started working with a friend, Wendy Dagworthy.
Yeah. I met Wendy Dagworthy, and she had already a little business going. And
good shirts, I recall.
Great shirts, with your initials that we used to put on the pocket. And I could by then drive and, you know, run around better, and she couldn't. So we sort of thought, she asked me if I'd, you know, go and join her, and I did that for 2 years, and we had such fun. It was great.
And then you were spotted. You were spotted by a company called Quorum, who had several designers under their umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, well-known for Ozzie Clarke, of course, now.
But what would they have spotted in you?
Absolutely no idea. I mean, absolutely no idea. I just think that they were looking, and maybe I was just there at the right time.
But what did you design for them? I mean, this would have been mid-70s.
Yeah.
So we're post-maxi. We're into what? We're into kind of wide-bottom trousers, tank tops.
Yeah, and it was, I tell you what we did do. It was actually the start of the New Avengers with Joanna Lumley. So we did her clothes for that.
A lot of black leather.
Yeah, and short dresses over leggings, that sort of thing. Sounds awful, doesn't it? But it was great then, when she was purdy, you know. Mm. And the funny thing was that then we dressed her in a fab 15 years later, which was quite nice.
Was that because you knew her? Did she come and ask you to do it?
No. I knew Jennifer, but in Jennifer Saunders, who wrote the thing, and we're good friends. But before that, the whole introduction came through Lenny Henry, and I did some stage clothes for him. And then met Dawn, of course, and then met Jennifer and did some things for their tour. And then when Jennifer wrote Ab Fab, we were sort of sat on our terrace having a glass of wine and giggling about it. And we just did the pilot, really, because there wasn't anybody else who she knew who produced clothes, really. And the whole thing was that she was supposed to be so effortlessly stylish. and Adina, played by Jennifer, got it always wrong but spent an absolute fortune on it. So there was this sort of contrast between the coolness of Patsy. She became madder as the series went on. But it was a very exciting, it was a good thing to do. It was jolly good fun.
So you were in the second half of your 20s, you were beginning to get there, and then you fell in love. You better tell me about your next
I fell in love with a Frenchman who lived in France, and we always seem to be saying goodbye, really, rather than hello, which, of course, when you're in love, you seem to be. And so this is about meeting David, and also because Ella Fitzgerald has the most beautiful voice in the history of the universe, I think.
But how strange the change from major to minor every time we say goodbye.
Ella Fitzgerald and Every Time We Say Goodbye. So, David was a great partner for you professionally, wasn't he?
Yeah, because he's the reason that we're still here, I think, probably.
Because his family had been in business, and they dealt in fabrics, I think, in Marseille.
Yeah. But he still claims he knows nothing about fashion.
But he was willing to sell up his share in the family business, and so he had the money to start you up.
Yeah. We spent that very quickly indeed. And,
but how was it in those early days? You know, you didn't really know what you were doing, did you?
Absolutely not. I mean, there was no organisation. It wasn't a London Fashion Week, which it is now. And because I had been under contract to Quorum and I decided to leave, they kept me on contract until the end of August. So we had about 4 weeks to sort of do a collection and make it, and literally went to a trade fair and hung it on a rail. And it was such an achievement to actually get the thing done that I remember we sort of sat in a collapsed heap at 9:05 when the exhibition opened, and we had all these garments hanging on the rail. And then Geraldine James from Harrods walked along and had a look through the rail and said, "Yes, I'd like to place an order." And we hadn't even got that far. We'd actually not really thought about anybody buying it. We hadn't even got an order pad. So somebody had to rush out and get a triplicate book. We were so organised. But
what about the money? How would you have had if it went very quickly, that money?
Well, we used that to sort of make the first sample collection. And
so how are you going to finance the orders?
Well, we then went to the bank with the orders. I mean, because we got several more. So I hadn't realised, because I'd had my name on the label at Quorum, that people were quite interested about what I was going to do on my own. So it came to see, and actually it was quite successful. So we went along to the bank, and that was another complete drama, and, you know, when my feminist comes to the fore, because we went to see the bank manager, and of course, because David is male, he addressed all his remarks to David, who couldn't speak any English at all.
No.
Well, hardly, you know, "The sky is blue, I love you," that's about it. And so I had this sort of job of translating what the bank manager said to David and then translating what David said to the bank manager. I was furious by the end of the meeting. But anyway, he did actually back the orders, so that was okay. And also, everybody was incredibly supportive. And we actually said, "We can't do this order unless you pay us within 7 days of us delivering, because we won't be able to exist." And everybody did, like a dream.
Record number six.
Number six is sort of about children and running round the sitting room and dancing and having a good time, really, when they were little.
"You, my bright girl, do you remember when we used to sing sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la
la 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 di da, la di da.
Van Morrison and Brown Eyed Girl, and memories for you, Betty Jackson, of dancing with your children, Pascal and Oliver, who are in their mid-teens now.
Yeah. Yes.
And am I right in thinking that because you had them quite late, didn't you?
I did.
You thought perhaps you couldn't, because of the
incident. Yeah, yeah. Well, they are sort of quite miracle children, really, because I only have half a womb after the accident, so shouldn't have been pregnant at all, really. Mm. And thought I wasn't, thought I'd got food poisoning after a Japanese trip. and came back, and my doctor said, no, no, you are. And so, yes, I do count myself as fortunate to have them.
And you and David manage their man, the house and the business. I mean, I know you have lots of help in them, but essentially you do it together yourselves. Mm. You've not had any outside backers for the business. You've really kept it
independent,
in-house. Mm-mm-mm. That must be quite tough on your relationship at times. Do you have sort of rules? We must not discuss business at home.
And it was very hard when the children were small. And inevitably, you know, problems that happen at the office spill over to home. But I absolutely think that David is the strength behind the company, because he has had to be the horrid person, you know, who's gone along with the money or without the money and said horrid things to people, whereas I come in and be Mrs. Nice Guy, you know. So,
but you're Mrs. Control too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh yes.
Oh yes.
But I think because we go to France often now, I'm aware more and more of what he actually gave up to come to do what he did, not knowing anything at all about it. But I think he's enjoyed it as well. It's been a sort of adventure, I think.
And you've moved with the fortunes of the fashion business, which means that these days you're much smaller than you were, because we all know there's a great dip at the end of the 80s and the recession and so on. And so these days your turnover is round about, what, 1.5 million?
Yeah, two probably now.
Two. Mm. I mean, what was it in its heyday in real terms? What would be the comparative
figure? We
were
up to sort of 5, 6, really. So there's a big difference. I mean,
aiming to get back there again? Are you happy with the size of it as it is?
I don't think I want to lose control as we did in the early 80s, because it was silly and, you know, we had no idea of where the merchandise was going and how it was selling, and also the quality. And I think the merchandise is much more considered now. I'm enjoying it much more, whereas then it was... There's whole chunks of it I can't even remember, because I was obviously just so exhausted with it all. Having said that, it wouldn't matter now if the turnover did increase, because now the manufacturing base is really sorted and we know what we're doing much more than we did before.
So Betty Jackson could be Britain's answer to Armani if we stick around.
No, I don't think I don't think ever that. But
record number 7.
I work with a fantastic young team, and we listen to music in the studio the whole time. And of course, you know, the music director for the fashion show is introducing new music, and I just love the sounds that Mary produces.
Moby and Porcelain. I mentioned that you appeal to people across the board, Betty, and the high-profile wearers. I mentioned Cherie Blair, but we go then to Melanie Blatt, former All Saint, and the grunge goddess Courtney Love. How do you sit and design for that kind of range of age and look?
When we start a collection, it's not just me doing it. We're a little team. We choose our favourite women. And it's not necessarily to do with whether they're beautiful or not. It's sort of to do with their personality and what they do in life. And so we have different sorts of women, different age groups, different... And when we go through the collection, we say, OK, is this one for Charlotte Gainsborough, or is it one for Charlotte Rampling, or is it one... And actually, it really focuses you on end usage of the clothes.
What's the look now, then?
I think it's to do with flamenco and Spanish and lots of colour and frills and mixing patterns together.
And
what's
the
spring?
And what's the autumn-winter going to look?
And the autumn is a little rougher... You know, Russian emigre, chiffon with sheepskin over the top, torn edges, a bit sort of, you know, running to get out of somewhere. And cold, cold, cold.
The last record.
This is to do with friends and how important friends are in my life, and about me hating country music, and a great friend of mine trying to make me believe in country music, and another friend of mine trying to also make me believe. And it's Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt. And We were at a lunch when she actually sat at the table and sang this beautifully unaccompanied, and it was the most magical moment with friends.
Oh, the Sisters of Mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. Well, they lay down beside me, I made my confessions to them.
Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt singing Sisters of Mercy. So if you could only take one of those eight records, Betty, which one would you take?
I think it would have to be Dusty.
You don't have to say you love me. So you could sing the chorus
loudly. Absolutely.
And what about your book?
My book is 50 Years of British Creativity, which is a sort of art book. And it's sort of my 50 years, really. I will miss going to art galleries. I will miss seeing exhibitions because we do that a lot. So just to have the pictures there would be an absolute joy and a thrill.
And what about your luxury?
Well, the luxury would have to be red lipstick, I think, probably. Huge amount. Firstly, because it was great with a tan, which I'll obviously have on a desert island, and good moisturiser too. And I want to be glamorous when I'm picked up. So it's an essential part. It has been an essential part of my life for the last 30 years. So.
And Patsy would approve.
Probably, yeah.
Betty Jackson, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your desert island discs.
It's been an absolute thrill. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.